Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Straight from the Source, streaming to you from the Heritage Radio Network studio in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York. My name's Clay Gordon, and in the 20 years that I've been exploring my chocolate life, I visited cacao farms from Bolivia to Belize and beyond, and spent time with farmers, cacao merchants, and some of the world's best chocolate makers and confectioners. Straight from the Source is inspired by the people I've met and what they've taught me. And this week, what I want to do is talk about some news that's been circulating in the cocoa world about fair trade and the future of fine chocolate. In the past week or so, several news reports have come to my attention, along with the receipt of a new book and a new report on climate change. And all of these things point to cocoa and chocolate really being at a crossroads, a fork in the road, as it were. We, and by we, I mean the chocolate industry, according to what it is that these reports seem to indicate, say that we have a couple of years maybe to address some of the fundamental issues in front of us, or we may lose control of our ability to be able to be in control of the future of cocoa and chocolate. First up, a report that came out as a result of a six-month transnational project led by the Forum for American the Forum for African Investigative Reporters, consisting of journalists from the Ivory Coast, Ghana, Cameroon, Nigeria, and the Netherlands, investigating the alleged benefits received by cacao farmers in Western Africa, sold by the Fair Trade label. The conclusions are fairly shocking. While the chocolate consumer in the West pays a significant markup for honest chocolate, these benefits amount to little or no improvement in the lives of most cocoa farmers. In some cases, because of fair trade cooperatives' increasing dominance, farmers in some cases are even worse off than before. The report concludes, the entire system is not fair, and an institution that perpetuates it can hardly call itself fair. The report goes on to say, if fair trade does not really change the lives of small farmers in West Africa, if all that the small farmer gets is a little handout and a not too long-lasting water pump every once in a while, is this really enough benefit to justify the large amounts of money paid by Western consumers to the institution of fair trade? Alternatively, is there no other better way to improve the lives of small cocoa farmers in West Africa? It's important to know here that, you know, like anything, the report went in looking to find a particular conclusion, and so they ended up finding the conclusion that they were looking for. To paint fair trade as so negatively, is not delivering any benefits whatsoever to anyone, is tarring the entire movement with a fairly broad brush. But nonetheless, the specific points that the investigators bring up are ones that are really, really important to consider, because they, in fact, counterbalance what is pretty much the prevailing positive tone, which comes from the Fair Trade organization itself. I mean, Fair Trade, as a general rule, the organization, doesn't talk about the implications when the system doesn't deliver what it is that they claim that they are delivering. As a matter of fact, it's important to know that the findings came from an investigation carried out by a group of journalists, FAIR, the Forum for African Investigative Reporters, in support with something called the Program for African Investigative Reporting. one of the impetuses for going after the report or for starting the investigation is that several years ago, an individual reporter went out and did some research on his own and put out a report which was critical of fair trade, or all of the claims that fair trade was making in the region. And as a result of that report, not only was his life threatened, and he had to go into hiding, but the lives of some of his sources were threatened as well. And I've learned that there's something which is called the Arizona Principle, which says that an investigation needs to be extended and deepened as soon as the journalist investigating the stories finds that he or she is under threat. The Arizona message is you can silence a journalist, but you cannot kill a story. If anybody is interested, the full links or the links to the full version of this report and to a reference on the origin of the Arizona Principle and in something called the Arizona Project are available on this episode's page on heritageradionetwork.org. So the pictures, the report says, of happy African farmers on the fair trade chocolate bought by consumers in the West are designed to make the consumer believe that the broad smiles are a result of actual fair trade, support, and better income. But the impression is false. Exploitation in the West African cocoa industry continues, only with a new player on the block. Fair trade itself, which benefits from the extra markup paid by supportive consumers. The fair trade label, which is issued by the Fair Trade's own certifying sister company, FloCert, hailed 20 years ago as an innovative institution which could improve the lives of farmers in the cocoa industry in West Africa, has not lived up to its promises. Farmers selling through the fair trade umbrella envelope do not necessarily receive more income for their harvests than ordinary farmers do. The farmers are often kept uninformed about the world market cocoa prices by the fair trade cooperatives that are meant to empower them. Farmers often receive little or no benefits from the bonuses and premiums that get paid to the fair trade cooperative from extra fair trade monies paid by consumers. Farmers often have not been told how or even that fair trade is supposed to benefit them. And farmers are sometimes squeezed out of farming in areas where fair trade cooperatives have become dominant. In fact, it's fast becoming more and more difficult for small farmers to stay independent. Successful fair trade co-ops are becoming bigger and bigger as the demand for certified cocoa from consumers increases. And I've actually seen this firsthand in Bolivia, where the dominant cocoa cooperative uses both its market positioning and its political connection to try to squash competition for market share and mind share. I mean, this is, you know, a perverse case where the dominant cooperative, which is fair trade certified and organic certified, uses its political connection to make sure that there are no competing programs of any size and any consequence in the country, which makes little sense to people who are outside of the industry. Why would somebody want to deny cocoa farmers a decent living? The political most people, if you've never been to Bolivia, you may not really understand how messed up the political situation is there. And even though the current president is somebody who comes from the countryside, somebody who is supposed to be a farmer and supporter of the farmers' rights and activities, is fairly cynical about his exploitation of that past and what it is that he promises to the people of Bolivia, especially the people of the countryside and the farmers. It is perverse, unfortunately, that a union, a cooperative, will try to ensure that other cooperatives whose work might, I suppose, undermine their position in the market, might undermine their political clout, might undermine the income that the cooperative generates and the benefits that are associated with that income brings to the people who run the cooperative. And even though the goal of the cooperative is to serve the people, serve the members, the actions of the cooperative are often at odds with the stated goal of the cooperative. Ghanaian farmers who were interviewed for the investigation, the report that I read, many of them had said that they had paid membership fees amounting to US$1. Doesn't sound a lot, but if the average annual income of a farmer is $200 a year, that's a fair amount of their income. They paid a dollar to the co-op because it made sense for them to pool their resources as a cooperative, even if it meant having to adhere to fair trade rules. So once you are a fair trade producing farmer, your farming has to live up to fair trade standards. This means that no children are in your family are allowed to help in the fields during school hours, even if this diminishes the family harvest and income. If you employ outside help, you have to pay a minimum wage, and there are rules regarding the use of pesticides, fertilizers, farming methods, and other and other aspects of the way you farm. These farmers go on to say that oftentimes they're not aware of the fact that that the cooperative they belong to is a part of a larger worldwide organization called Fair Trade. Often they are not aware actually of how much cacao the cooperative sells. They're not aware of the premium that the cooperative earns from the cacao that it sells. They're not aware of the principles by which or the means by which the premium, which is paid to the cooperative, is in fact distributed. I mean, who gets it, when they get it? Farmers will sometimes say that they receive token payments, a dollar here, a dollar there, maybe a couple of times a year, and they assume that they're somehow gifts from the cooperative itself, not necessarily that this is a part of a premium which is being paid for their fair trade cacao. And finally, the report goes on to say, or at least the part of the report that I'm going to talk about today, and I encourage everybody to go and look at the full text of the report, is that you know, fair trade itself, or larger cooperatives, are making it harder for smaller farmers to be able to sell their cocoa. The cooperatives get their bargaining power, their ability to charge more for prices, their ability to do more with the premiums that they get by being larger and larger, therefore being able to sell more cocoa, supposedly at a higher price, and supposedly as much as possibly can on the fair trade market and being able to get the premium. So the smaller farmer finds it far more difficult to be able to find alternative markets for their cocoa. Sometimes the only alternative market or the only market for their cocoa is the local fair trade cooperative. And they find themselves having to become a part of that cooperative in order to be able to have a market for their cocoa locally because local buyers are discouraged from going out into the countryside and finding sources for themselves, which is unfortunately one of the is an unfortunate byproduct of the way the system is currently being implemented. That goes on to say there's another report that was recently released by the title Sustainable Cocoa Action Needed in 2 Years, Not 10. This is a full report, something called the 2012 Cocoa Barometer, which is from a group called the CocoaBarometer.org, which is a group of non-governmental organizations, many of which practice in West Africa, but also practice around the world, who got together and did some of the research on their own and said that, according to the report, changes need to happen in the near future because the cocoa industry is in desperate need of change. The situation of aging farmers and youth pursuing other lines of work is specifically frightening. And that is from Anthony Fountain, the director of a group called Stop the Traffic, who was involved in the creation of the report. We're going to talk about that report when we come back from the break, talking a little bit about the cocoa world, some new news about how fair trade, what fair trade is and how fair it is. And we'll be talking about the report as well as share some my opinions about a new book that's just been released called Raising the Bar, The Future of Fine Chocolate, when we get back from the break. Was the
protocol? You're listening to CO by Shadowbox on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to Straight from the Source on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Clay Gordon. I'm the creator and moderator of thechocolatelife.com and author of the IACP finalist book, Discover Chocolate. Today, I'm covering some new news in the world of cocoa and chocolate. There are links to the full text of the report I was talking about in the first half of the episode on the Straight from the Source page on Heritage Radio Network, and the link to the report I'm just about to talk about is also there as well. So, sustainable cocoa. Action needed in 2 years, not 10, produced by produced by the Cocoa Barometer, an organization called Cocoa Barometer, is part of their 2012 Cocoa Barometer report. The report is produced by a number of non-governmental organizations involved in cocoa and other trades working in West Africa and other places in the world. And they say that systemic change needs to happen in the near future because the cocoa industry is in desperate need of change. The situation of aging farmers and youth pursuing other lines of work is specifically frightening. The director, Anthony Fountain, the director of Stop the Traffic, which is one of the organizations involved in producing the report, went on to say, we need to see real, holistic solutions that include infrastructure, market access, poverty, and working conditions. Just increasing productivity will not solve the problems. Certification and increasing productivity are necessary, but must be complemented by other steps, such as increasing the price farmers receive for the cocoa, improving local infrastructure, and renewed focus on social and labor conditions in producing countries. The report goes on to say, we're starting to see individual industry action or individual company action, but it needs more coordination. What we're not seeing is a collective response, and farmers and traders have to be at the table to be a part of this. And that last, I don't think, can be underestimated or spoken too loudly. Farmers and traders have to be at the table to be a part of this. What we're seeing is, as the report says, individual companies. A new company called Mondelez, you may not have heard of them, but Kraft recently spun off. It's chocolate divisions, all of the bits of Kraft that are in the chocolate business, into a new company called Mondelez. Don't know why it's called Mondelez. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me or reflect anything that might be a part of its business. But Mondelez is now a separate subsidiary. And Mondelez recently announced that they were investing $400 million over the next 10 years in creating a sustainable supply chain. Unfortunately, at no point in the conversation that I was able to see did Mondelez ever mention what sustainable meant. What does sustainable mean when creating a sustainable supply chain? And they didn't talk about how they determined how they were going to figure out what sustainable meant. What I was able to see is that their definition of sustainable was being able to make sure that they would be able to essentially maintain the status quo, that they would be able to continue to purchase cocoa over the next 10 years, and that cocoa would be able to be purchased at a price that was favorable to the company, and that they were investing in some improvements in infrastructure, but it's not clear exactly what that $40 million a year over the next 10 years will be able to buy in terms of improved infrastructure. Yes, it's important to be able to improve the quality of the fermentation facilities. It's important to improve the quality of the drying facilities, just overall to improve the quality of cocoa that is produced. Yes, it's important to teach farmers how to handle their cocoa better than they are, but handling the cocoa, essentially being better farmers, unfortunately, being better farmers almost always equates to more labor, spending more time on the farm, among the trees, being able to do the work that's necessary to keep the plants, the trees productive. So that means pruning the trees. It means clearing the undergrowth. It means removing pods, which are obviously diseased, so that they don't infect other pods and other trees. The challenge becomes there's no concomitant promise by the chocolate companies to be able to ensure that the farmer gets paid properly for that labor, right? The chocolate companies are relying on, for the most part, on third-party certification systems like Fairtrade, the one we heard about, the one I was talking about in the first part of the program, to be able to deliver on the social benefit aspect of this, to be able to deliver the increases in standard of living to the cocoa farmer. And unfortunately, as we see, that's not just happening. And as I've mentioned before, the chocolate companies have a huge conflict of interest here. As public companies, they're required to do everything they can to maximize shareholder return. And if that meant paying $2 or $3 a pound more for their cocoa beans, that would mean that their margins would be squeezed tremendously. And although spending $2 or $3 a pound more doesn't sound like a lot, it's important to know that right now cocoa beans basically are bought from the farm at around a dollar a pound in Ghana, or that's about what's paid to the farmer, a dollar a pound. So even doubling the price would have a tremendous impact if that price actually made it to the farmer. But there are 3 million metric tons, right, or about 6 billion pounds of cocoa beans that are harvested every year. And if the chocolate companies had to pay another $6 billion for the raw ingredient used to make chocolate, that would significantly increase the price of the chocolate that they had to charge the consumer. And the consumer would probably push back and go, hey, you know, that's way too expensive. I'm not going to pay that much money. The companies would be hammered by Wall Street and the stock exchanges around the world because they're required to do everything they can to drive a profit. They're not required, or they're not rewarded for being good citizens of the earth. They're rewarded for essentially redistributing money into the pockets of shareholders. And it's why this coordination among the chocolate companies is required. Taken piecemeal, taken one at a time, taken little bits at a time, there's just no real way that they're going to be able to address the challenges that face them. These are, in fact, problems that the industry has itself created over the past 20 years. They've created a system where they can dominate pricing. where they can, in fact, on a cartel-like basis, even though there's no way to prove that they're, in fact, colluding, they're able to dominate pricing. There are four or five companies who buy the vast majority of cocoa in the world, and because of that fact, they're able to control the price of it because they're buying all of it. One of the things that's coming along that's just really starting to be recognized is the effect of climate change on the growing regions around the world. We're starting to see changes in rainfall patterns in West Africa and, you know, all over the world in agricultural areas. And while that does have an effect, obviously, on the plants, one of the larger effects that people tend not to think about is what does it do to the water table? What does it do to the aquifers? What does it do to the amount of water sitting under the surface? And how does that affect crops, tree crops especially, that are being grown? And so what we're seeing, you know, is one of the ironic consequences of attempting to increase production by, for example, by encouraging farmers to plant quantity or varieties of cocoa that are much more highly productive than the varieties that are there now, is that we're seeing faster depletion of not only the nutrient levels in the soil, but we're also seeing much faster depletion of the water table, lowering of the aquifers as these trees just pump water out of the ground in order to be able to grow the increased number of pods that the farmers are asked to grow on behalf of the chocolate companies. So we've created this, you know, really, really weird, vicious cycle where we want to do good. We want to be able to improve the lives of the farmer, but the projects that we undertake, the ways that we go about trying to improve things, have turned out to have unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences are, in fact, almost as bad in some cases as the problem that they're trying to solve. Finally, there's a new book that's been released. It's called Raising the Bar, The Future of Fine Chocolate. And it's written by Pam Williams and Jim Eber. People may know the name Pam Williams. She's the founder of an online school, as well as a real-world school, a virtual and a physical school, for making chocolate in Vancouver, British Columbia. It's called École Chocolat. She's also the publisher of a website called ChocoMap, and is heavily involved in a group called the Fine Chocolate Industry Association. I come from, I'm going to try to have one of the authors, either Pam or Jim, on the program coming forward in a future week. But one of the things that strikes me about the book is that, I come from a background of reportage, which meant that when I had an editor, and I was doing a story, if I had some sort of conflict of interest or some sort of connection with the story that I was writing, I had to reveal that connection. I had to let the editors know, certainly, and let the readers know that that there was this connection, and that somehow my connection with the organization or connection with the topic wasn't going to influence what I was writing. Now, so what that makes it difficult for me to understand is who the market or who the audience for this book is. If the audience for the book is only the fine chocolate industry professional, then my concerns about the book, I suppose, are a little less valid, but they're a little less pressing. It turns out that Pam Williams owns the publishing company, or is a part owner in the publishing company, Wilmore Publishing. Has been a significant member of the Fine Chocolate Industry Org, Fine Chocolate Industry Association, and has also been involved in a project that the Fine Chocolate Industry Association is working on, which is called the Heirloom Cacao Project. And The first part of the book reads like a manifesto for the Fine Chocolate Industry Association's Heirloom Cacao Project. And my challenge with the book on first reading is that Pam doesn't mention that, her connection with the whole process. Now, people who know Pam and people who know the FCIA and the people who know the Heirloom Cacao Project aren't going to have a problem with that, because they're going to know what the connection is. And so if the market for the book is, in fact, the industry professional, then, you know, maybe the issue, you know, that comes to mind is actually not an issue at all. But if the book makes it out into the general public and people are not aware of the connection that Pam has with the Fine Chocolate Industry Association, as well as the Heirloom Cacao Project, then, you know, that what I see as a potential conflict is not going to be one that ever gets raised and is ever going to surface. And so what gets presented is actually going to be looked at in a very, very different light. So that's an issue that I hope to discuss with one of the authors in a future program, as well as to talk about the Heirloom Cacao Project itself, because by itself, I mean, of itself, it's a very, very interesting project, looking at the future of fine flavor chocolate and how to preserve it, and the impact it's likely to have, not only on the fine flavor chocolate industry, the fine chocolate industry, but also the bulk chocolate industry, the people, you know, is there going to be a change in the way the chocolate industry works in general, as a result of the work that's being done to be able to preserve fine flavor cocoa varietals. It's a very, very interesting question, and one that I hope to talk about in a future episode. So a couple of things. That's it for today's show. But next week, I'm scheduled to be doing some chocolate demos on Tuesday and Thursday here in New York at a new chocolate shop called Two Beans on Park Avenue, just south of Grand Central. You can check out the events calendar on thechocolatelife.com for more information about those demos. And I welcome all listeners of the program who are in the New York area or are going to be traveling to New York for the holidays to come by and say hello. I want to thank Jack Inslee for engineering today's show, and thank the rest of the Heritage Foods USA and Heritage Radio Network teams for their very hard work building, maintaining, and growing the Heritage Radio Network. Straight from the Source comes to you every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or go to heritageradionetwork.org, click on the Straight from the Source logo on the homepage, go to my page, and then be able to stream all the episodes from the site. If you're not already a member of Heritage Radio Network, please join me and show your support for this show and for the network. If you have questions that you'd like to hear answered on future programs, give us a call at 718-497-2128. Email the show at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or contact me through thechocolatelife.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.